Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhouseonline.com.au.
It all begins with the simple request to deliver the eulogy of Albert Lewis, an aging rabbi. Then along comes Henry Covington, a Christian pastor running a broken-down church for the inner-city homeless. A rabbi, a pastor, and a writer with a lot of questions. It all adds up to sound like pretty much the makings of a good book, and it actually is. Mitch Albom is the author of books like The Four People You Meet in Heaven, For One More Day, and the phenomenally popular Tuesdays with Morrie, now the best-selling memoir of all time. His latest book, Have a Little Faith, describes how that rabbi and that pastor begin to melt his cynicism about God and faith. Mitch Albom is in Australia and with us now. Mitch, welcome to Open House.
Thank you so much.
What I didn't mention in that intro is that you're an award-winning sports writer, which is a large part of your career, and you still do it even after the success of all of these books. Now, there aren't too many sports writers who write books about the meaning of life, and there aren't too many sports writers that can turn a phrase with the elegance that you can. How did a sports guy end up writing books about the meaning of life?
Well, I guess in fairness to all the good sports writers around the world, you don't come out of the womb as a sports writer. You sort of fall into it, and I had been a musician before I was a journalist, and so obviously there was a whole different track there. And then when I became a journalist, I didn't want to be a sports writer. I wanted to be a social issues writer, but that was where the job was, and so I took it, and one thing led to another. And I've always tried to, at least my writing in the States when it comes to sports, I try to look for the more human angles and not the what we call the X's and the O's. In fairness, I probably would still just be doing that exclusively if not for something that happened 15 years ago now, when an old professor of mine named Maurice Schwartz was dying from motor neuron disease, and I happened to see him on TV, and I had lost touch with him in my sort of rush to ambition and money-making and all the rest, and I felt kind of guilty. I hadn't seen him in 16 years. So I called him up, and one call led to a visit, one visit led to another visit, and ultimately I ended up writing a book to pay his medical bills called Tuesdays with Morrie. And that really changed my whole life, because when a book like that comes out and it gets the reception that it did, although unanticipated, all of a sudden, every day of your life, people aren't coming up and asking you who's going to win the Super Bowl. They're coming up and saying to you, my wife just died of cancer, and the last thing we did was read your book together. Can I talk to you? And all of a sudden, your world starts to change, and I think that's what happened with me.
In fact, people coming up to you in airports and stopping you in the street, I mean, certainly soon after Tuesdays with Morrie, you're becoming something of a grief counselor, aren't you?
Well, it was funny. Amy Tan, who wrote The Joy Luck Club and many other wonderful books, was one of the few people to read Tuesdays with Morrie in its manuscript form. She's a friend of mine, and I had sent it to her. I said, what do you think? I've never written a book like this before. And she said, well, I have two comments for you. One, it's a wonderful book, and two, you're about to become everybody's rabbi. And I didn't know what she meant by that, but in the 15 years that have passed, I have certainly found out, and it's been interesting.
Yeah, well, how did that book change your life? Because it really did change your life.
Well, I had been going probably about 1,000 miles an hour before that, and my sole concerns were basically for myself and my ambition and my achievement and my accomplishment, and I can't say that I was unique, at least in America, for someone who was in his mid-30s. And then I re-encountered this old professor who sort of reminded me of what I had been like 16 years earlier when I wasn't thinking about money and ambition. I just was sort of wanting to find my place in the world. And here he was dying from this terrible disease. And I saw that the things that mattered to him and gave him comfort had nothing to do with the things that I was spending my time doing. And he constantly reminded me, you know, he had this phrase that he always had a twinkle in his eye when he talked. And he would say, when you get to where I am, and then he would stop and he would look at me and raise a finger and he'd say, and you will get to where I am. And I think it was that sort of thinking that, you know, I am going to be him one day, hopefully not with that terrible affliction, but there will be an end to my days. And he was so satisfied and happy with how he had led his life that even this terrible disease couldn't kill his spirit. And I guess I wanted to lead a life a little bit more like that. And so after the book came out, and even before the book came out, I started to put the brakes on a lot of the things that I did, which literally were 110 hours a week of work, and started to think more about these kinds of issues. And certainly I've written, my books have now been sort of in that vein, and these are the issues I think about. I still work a variety of jobs, but I don't work any of them full-time. I'm a total part-timer. I've put a bigger emphasis on my family and on certainly on my charitable work and being involved in my community and taking responsibility for if you have a voice and you have success, you mm-hmm. should try to do something with it. And I probably every day, you know, literally every day somebody talks to me about Maury and some of the lessons I learned when he was dying, and so they're always with me.
Yeah. You've had thousands of letters in response to Tuesdays with Maury. What would be the most memorable you've had or, you know, out of all of the sheer volume?
I think the ones that get to me the most are when I'll get a packet will arrive at my house, and I've come to know what these things are now because I've had more than one. They'll be... real, they'll be stuffed. It'll be a yellow envelope, and it'll be stuffed, almost bursting at the edges. And it'll be in plain ink, you know, handwriting, not typed or anything. And it'll have a return address of a school. Hmm. And I'll open it up, and there'll be just dozens of essays or papers that a fifth grade class or a sixth grade class wrote after reading Tuesdays with Maury. And I never thought when I wrote Tuesdays with Maury that children would gravitate to it. I really thought it was a book probably for older people who were sort of facing their mortality. Mm. The number of children around the world who have taken to that book and have read it and absorbed it, and the things that they write, you know, with the penmanship that's, you know, they put little squirrely cues on top of their eyes and, you know, those little symbols all over it. Yeah. And yet they really do get sort of the essence of what the story is about. And I think those are the ones that move me the most because it's really hopeful to see that young kids who sometimes we dismiss as lost to the computer generation do, when stimulated anyhow, have a good sensibility about what life is supposed to be about.
Mm. Mitch Albom is our guest on Open House tonight, author of the phenomenally selling Tuesdays with Maury, and also other books like The Four People You Meet in Heaven, For One More Day, and this new one, Have a Little Faith. Now, Have a Little Faith begins by you being asked by your childhood rabbi to deliver his eulogy. Now, you've been raised a Jew, you've attended Jewish schools, grew up in the synagogue, yet you've drifted from your faith by this time, haven't you?
Oh, yes, quite a bit. I was like probably many of your listeners. My youth was sort of my parents telling me, you have to go here, you have to go there, you got to go to religious school, we're dragging you to this, that. And then as soon as I sort of hit 18, it was as if somebody opened the door to the prison, you know. It's like, you're sprung. And so I basically just walked away from it. I didn't have any tragic loss of faith. I didn't stop believing in God or anything like that. I just became apathetic, you know, sort of the same thing that happened prior to Tuesdays with Maury. I became more interested in my own success, my own career. I was young, I was healthy, nobody around me was dying, all the things that tend to draw you back to faith sometimes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I just sort of figured I'll go my way and God will go his way and we'll be okay. And I sort of went along that way. And then even as more time passed, I think I became somewhat cynical about religion. When I started seeing things like ethnic cleansing and the Catholic Church scandals and terrorism and all these things done in the quote-unquote name of faith that were hardly faithful. And then I got asked out of the blue in this hallway by this 82-year-old clergyman who was really basically the only one I'd ever had because I never bothered to join another temple or anything because I knew I wasn't going to go. So essentially he was the one from the time I was 6 months old, the only person I ever thought of as a man of God, you know, in my life. And here he is saying to me, will you do the eulogy at my funeral? And all I could think of was to say, well, if I'm going to do that, I need to get to know you as a man. You know, I only know you from the seats, you know, and the cheap seats, not even the good seats. So I need to spend some time with you and see you as a human being. And he said, okay, I accept. And that became what I thought would be a couple of weeks, a couple of months of trying to get to know him, and it turned out to be 8 years. He lived till he was 90 years old. So it was an 8-year journey and sort of seeing faith from the other side lived quietly on a day-to-day basis, and I have to say it really changed my perspective.
And having read the book, I mean, Albert Lewis, he's certainly a character, isn't he?
He is. He wasn't your typical clergyman. He first of all, he loved to joke around. He was a tall, handsome guy, you know, and with a twinkle in his eye, and he loved to sing every sentence. I mean, if you would see him in his 80s and you say, how you doing, instead of him saying, I'm okay or I'm fine, he would always answer, the old gray rabbi ain't what he used to be. Ain't what, you know, and he'd sing like the whole stanza, you know, he'd be there, okay already, stop singing. And his sermons were always kind of unusual. He would bring in comics or kids' books. He once brought in a squash and a piece of wood to the pulpit, and he took a hammer and he smashed the squash into a million pieces, and then he banged on the wood over and over again and nothing happened. And then he used that to give an illustration of things that grow up fast or happen fast or flashy, like a squash, are often more easily destroyed than that which takes a long time to grow, like wood or tradition, which, of course, he also sang, you know, tradition, tradition, like that. So, I don't know, he was just captivating. You know, you like to be in his presence. And over the course of the 8 years, as he was approaching the end of his life, I think many of us wonder, well, do men of God, do they have some kind of in, you know, when it comes to the end of life? Do they know that they're going to get taken care of because they've served God? They have a special path to heaven. And it was interesting to talk to him about all that.
Mm. And then you introduce us to Henry Covington, who I might just add is probably my newest hero now. He's pastor of My Brother's Keeper Ministries, running this broken down old church for the inner city homeless in Detroit.
Yeah, and I have to say, when I met him, I run a homeless charity for the homeless in Detroit, and that's how I met him, because I had heard about this church that was running a homeless program out of its church, but people slept on the floor, and the church had a giant hole in its roof. I mean, a massive hole in its roof that rain and snow literally came in on top of the pews. They couldn't heat it because the heat would go right up through the hole, and they actually at one point had to build a plastic tent inside their own church just to have some place to huddle under, to stay out of the snow, and be able to pray. And so it was quite an unusual place to be holding a homeless shelter. And then I met this pastor, and he was even more unusual, because unlike Albert Lewis, who had been a pious man pretty much his whole life, here's Henry Covington, who when he was younger did everything. I mean, drugs, sold drugs, used drugs, robbed people, thief. The only time he'd ever been a synagogue, he said, when he was robbing it. And he was in prison when he was 19 for a manslaughter charge and a crime he actually didn't commit. And when he was 30 years old, he was so sort of broken down and such a junkie and hopeless that one night he robbed his own drug dealers because he couldn't think of anybody else to rob. And then he realized, uh-oh, they know where I live. And so he ended up on the ground with a shotgun behind a row of trash cans in the middle of the night, telling his wife and his child to hide and stay away from the windows. And he was sure that the next car that came around the street would, you know, just fire out the window and blow him and his wife and his child away. And so he did what people do in those desperate hours. He looked to the sky and he said, Jesus, if you can get me out of this, you can have me in the morning. You know, just get me through and I'm yours. Mm. And miraculously, no cars came and no bullets were fired. And when he woke up the next morning on the street there, the sun came up and it was Easter morning. And he crawled back into bed and drank a bottle of NyQuil to try to knock himself out. And when he woke up the next day, he did the same thing. And the next day, he did the same thing until he finally broke free of the drug's hold on him. And then slowly, over the course of the next 20 years, worked his way back to decency. He actually kept his promise. Mm-hmm. And when I encountered him, he was now running this church, for which he got no salary, for indigent and homeless people with the hole in the roof. Here's a guy who had once made $500,000 in a year worth of selling drugs, now working for peanuts, taking care of the poor. And he was about as opposite as I could think of the clergyman that I was used to. And yet I was seeing him, and then I was going out to New Jersey, 1,000 miles away, to see the Albert Lewis in the suburbs, and then coming back to the inner city and then out to the suburbs. And I began to realize between these trips that although everything looked different, you know, black, white, Jewish, Christian, inner city, suburban, they were united by this one incredible thing called faith that sort of guided both of these men despite their very different paths.
This is Open House right across the nation. Mitch Albom is with us. Tuesdays with Morrie is his best-known book. And then the new one, Have a Little Faith, talks about, this story of this rabbi and this Christian pastor that kind of got him thinking more about faith. So at the beginning of Have a Little Faith, you say that everybody is running from God, and you kind of go through biblical characters, Adam and Moses and Abraham and the whole lot. Are you still running from God? You mentioned your own running from God earlier on. Are you still running from God after meeting these two men?
No. I would say that the biggest thing that has happened in the last 10 years since I was asked to do that eulogy in that hallway is that I've lost my cynicism. I can't sustain it. I would challenge anyone who has been with me over the course of the last 10 years and seen what I've seen to be cynical about faith or about God. I watched Henry Covington, the pastor you mentioned, drive around Detroit in the worst sections in an old beat-up car with food on the hood of his car, just you know, turkeys and hams and things he got from food banks, cheeses and bread. And he would honk his horn, and the homeless people who were squatting in these apartments would see this car with food on the hood and the roof, and they'd come running out, and he literally would would feed them. I mean, just feed them. He didn't, no quid pro quo. He didn't ask for anything in return. He didn't have to join his church. He never even identified himself. He just gave them food. I mean, what's more Christian than that? Or he was, when he ran the homeless program, and every night when the 80, 90, 100 men would bed down in sub-zero weather on the floor of this church, and then they would turn the lights off, I would see Henry sitting up there 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, midnight, 1 in the morning, just watching over them because he felt, well, this is my church. I need to make sure that they're safe. I would watch the Reb, the Rabbi Lewis, the 90 years old, still dialing his congregants and just seeing how they're doing, making sure they're going to come. And he'd long since been retired. He wasn't getting paid for it, but he felt it was important to stitch together the community and keep everybody connected. And you see this kind of these kinds of small incidents over and over and over again. And how can you be cynical about it? I mean, you're going to be cynical when people are huddled inside a tent in their own church praying, the poorest people you can imagine, you're going to go, oh, stupid people. I mean, only the most hard-hearted person would do that. And I think gradually I just realized that faith, yeah, there are people who pervert it. Yes, there are people who do things in the name of faith that have nothing to do with faith. But that's not faith. That's hate. It's just disguised as faith. But true faith, true practice, true belief in something bigger than yourself and an obligation to your fellow man can be a beautiful thing, and it doesn't have to be your own faith. And I think that was sort of the biggest lesson to me. Is that, you know, we tend to not trust anything that's not ours when it comes to faith. If it's different, we don't trust it. We never say it out loud, but privately we tell ourselves, ours good, theirs bad. You know, ours right, theirs wrong. And what I was able to see, even in faiths other than my own, is that practice purely, there are a lot of similarities between at least the major faiths of the world, taking care of the poor, honoring your family, being humble, thanking a higher presence for what there is and the good that there is in life. And I stopped running. I mean, I don't see any reason to run. Actually, I sort of turned the other direction, and not in a finger-wagging way, not like, okay, I need to convert anybody else. And Have a Little Faith is not a dogmatic book. I think if you've read it, you would agree. It doesn't tell anybody you have to do anything. It's not an instruction manual. It just is sort of a celebration of what even a cynical person can learn and be moved by when it comes to faith.
Yeah, and so the God you've come to believe in, would you say, I mean, the interesting thing about the way that you've written the book is that the two men of God, if we want to put that phrase, are actually quite kind of related in when it comes to world religions. I mean, Christianity grew out of Judaism,
right.
So there's a connection there. So while there are some social similarities between a lot of the world's religions in terms of, like you said, you know, honoring your parents and those kinds of things, I mean, in the essential text, there's actually major, major differences in terms of the nature of God. What is God like? The nature of salvation. How do you achieve salvation? How do you find it? Does God give it to you as a free gift? Do you earn it? All of those kinds of things. Now, Judaism and Christianity are a little bit more aligned. So would you say you've come to believe in the God of Judaism again?
Well, I think I, like anybody, what you're raised with as a child is the thing you're probably most comfortable with, although people do have conversions later in life. And I would say, yeah, from my particular case, that's probably true. But I remember asking the Reb, the old rabbi, and we used to call him the Reb, that's why I keep, it's hard for me not to. It was like a superhero nickname, you know, like the Hulk or the Thing and the Reb. We used to call him the Reb. And I asked him at one point, this is an obvious question to ask clergymen, okay, how can all these faiths in the world exist? I mean, doesn't one have to be right and all the other ones have to be wrong? Isn't that kind of, you know, factually, mathematically how it has to work in all the things that you just pointed out, for example? And he said, well, here's how I look at it. Do you believe that God created trees? I said, okay, he created trees. He said, well, why did he create different trees? He's God. Everything he does is perfect, right? Why didn't he create one tree and say, that's a tree. That's a God's tree. It can't be any better than that. All trees on the world are going to look like this. But he didn't. There's pine trees and oak trees and redwood trees and spruce trees and all the rest of it. But they're still all God's creation, right? I said, yeah. He said, well, why can't you kind of look at the different faiths of the world that way? If you believe we all sort of came from one man, you know, or one beginning, whether you believe it scientifically or biblically with Adam, then why can't you accept that maybe the faiths are a little bit like the trees, and there's different ways of worshiping a higher power, but God will figure it out, you know, when we get to whatever's beyond this. It's not our job to try to wag fingers at one another and say, you know, mine's right, yours wrong, therefore I have to kill you. That certainly isn't God-like.
Absolutely.
That much we know. And so the rest of it, there are certain things I just don't know something for sure. But I do know what I believe in my heart, and I can respect what somebody else believes in their heart purely as well. I don't need to hurt them or tell them that they're wrong just because it may not have the same name as me or may not work the same way as my view or anything like that. And I thought that that was a beautiful way for a clergyman to sort of get his congregants to encourage them to get along with one another. You know,
I wonder whether inherent in all of this conversation, Mitch, is actually the fact that we've lost the art of being able to come together with people of different faiths and actually have a conversation about these kinds of things and actually still accept one another without agreeing. Because while I agree with half of what you've said, I disagree with half of the others. In the sense, because of the exclusivity that so many religions actually claim, that, you know, to take them at their face value and look at their essential text, you have to say, well, you know, is there actually one that has got the right to say, well, no, there is actually a special divine revelation here? But the issue, what you're saying, is that doesn't give anybody the right to say, you're evil, you're the scum of the earth, we need to eradicate you. That's
exactly
a completely different issue.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's all that I would suggest in terms of how faiths get along. Look, the last conversation I had with the Reb just before he died was about heaven. And it was very instructive because he was making a joke about it. He hoped I had many more years on earth, so that way when we got to see each other again, we'd have a lot to talk about. And I said, do you really think we're going to see each other again? And he said, well, don't you? And I said, well, let's face it, I don't think I'm going where you're going. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, come on. I mean, they have to have a special wing for people like you, you know, you know, pious and righteous. You know, you're a man of God. And he looked at me very sweetly, and he said, but you're a man of God, too. Everyone is. And in that sentence is, to me, the essence of everything you just mentioned, and is, to me, the essence of what Have a Little Faith about, and what I think he was trying to teach me, is that faith shouldn't be about wagging a finger at one another and saying, I'm more pious than you are, even within the same faith, which you certainly could have done. Okay. It shouldn't be about wagging a finger at someone else and saying, my faith is more right than yours is, which he could have done to other faiths in the world. It is about turning to the person next to you, across the street from you, wherever you run into them, and saying, you're a child of God too. Everyone is. And if we really believe that, then we would have to treat one another better, and we would have to be more tolerant, and we'd have to be kinder, because we would see everyone as more like us than different, and we would not hurt our own, so why would we hurt them? And I think that that's a much better way of looking at the world's religions than it is to say, well, mine gives me the right to destroy yours.
Yes, yes. And where do we get that idea from? But from that beautiful first book of both the Hebrew and the Christian scriptures, the book of Genesis, which says that we're made in the image of God.
There you go.
Profound, profound statement. Just one more question before we leave this whole topic. The whole issue of judgment, you know, once we die, we do actually come before the judgment seat of God, is both a very strong theme in both the Hebrew and the Christian scriptures, as well as even some other religions as well. That wasn't touched on in the book. Was there any particular reason for that? Or,
well, I'm not sure I would say it wasn't touched on. I think, for example, Henry, towards the end of the book, I went and saw him one night, and after all the good that I had observed him doing and all the kindness that he had done, he had taken a homeless man into his own home and let him live with him for a year, and the guy literally turned his life around, straightened out, and now is an elder of the church. And I sat on the very couch where that homeless man slept in this tiny little rundown house that Henry was living in with his three kids and his wife, and I made a joke, a bad one, saying it looked like a life of crime paid better than a life of God. And he said to me, well, I'm where I'm supposed to be. And I said, what do you mean? He said, when I was younger, I broke every one of the Ten Commandments. And I said, oh, come on, not every one. And he said, yeah, every one. And I went through all of them, and even when I got to murder, he said, well, I never pulled the trigger on anyone, but I might as well have. And then he said, I may be going to hell. I don't know. It's quite possible for the things I've done. God is justified, and he will not be mocked. And I said, well, what about all the good that you're doing? He said, no, you can't work your way into heaven, and that's not why I'm doing it. I'm only doing this because I hope I get a few days on earth to do some good so that when I die, my record on this planet isn't just all the bad that I've done. But then I accept what God does with me. I accept wherever he's going to send me. And I know there are some who will say, well, if he's accepted Jesus as a Savior, his sins will all be forgiven. Mm-hmm. There are others who feel like there are some that can't be forgiven. And with the Reb, I remember it was typical for him because he was so sort of elfish and funny about things. I actually asked him, what if you find out that judgment, heaven, you know, when you first get there, is going to be you get 5 minutes with God, and you can do anything you want with those 5 minutes, and you ask any question, and you'll get your answers. What would you do with your 5 minutes? And he said, well, first I would ask God to take two of those minutes and give them to my family and be there for him, for them, if they're grieving or they're seeking answers or something like that. I said, okay, that's two. Then I take two of the minutes and give them to anyone else on the planet who needs God's help. Rather, you know, I don't need the whole 5 minutes. Spend the 2 minutes answering their prayers or speaking to them. Okay, that leaves you 1 minute. What would you do with the 1 minute? And he says, well, I guess I would say, all right, Lord, I've spent my whole life worshiping you and honoring you and trying to live by your commandments, and I hope I've influenced some people to do good, and I hope I've lived up to your wishes and led a good life on earth. So, now that I'm here, what's my reward? And I said, well, what do you think he'll answer? And he looked at me very mischievously, and he said, he'll say, reward? What are you talking about, reward? That's what you were supposed to do. And I thought that was such a brilliant sort of analysis of it, because, you know, we all expect, well, if I do this, then I'll get this. If I do this, then I'll get that. If I score these points, then I'll have that. We'll be judged that way. And isn't it more realistic that, you know, being good to one another, taking care of one another, living by God's commandments is what you're supposed to do? What do you have to get a reward for? It's its own reward. So I think I sort of looked at your question with those kinds of answers.
Well, after your time with Maurice Schwartz all of those years ago, and now Albert Lewis and Henry Covington, what do you think the meaning of life is? I mean, that's certainly where your books have kind of spiraled for the last few years. What do you think it is to end on a giant question for you?
Nothing like a small one, right? Well, I think it has to do with other people, to put a vague kind of thing on it. I know it. What it doesn't have to do with. I know it doesn't have to do with money. It doesn't have to do with accomplishment or fame or success. I've watched enough people dying and in their closing days to see how little those things offer any comfort whatsoever. And the only thing that does are the people that they have around them and the love that they've been able to make and give and leave behind them. So I know that the meaning of life has to do with what you do for other people, the kindness that you show them, the memories you make with them, the good that hopefully you've done while you've been here. And I remember to end with an anecdote from the Reb. We had this question about what's happiness, which I think is a little tied into what you're asking. What's the meaning of happiness? What's the secret to happiness? And we were in a hospital when I asked him this. He had suffered a stroke, and we heard a baby out in the hallway. The baby was crying, and the Reb said, do you hear that baby crying? I said, yeah. He said, "Did you know? Have you ever noticed how when babies come into the world, their little fists are clenched up? And I said, yeah. He said, that's because babies, not knowing any better, think that they can have it all. They're going to take everything. He said, but look at me. I'm an old man. I'm about to die, and how am I going to die? And he opened his palms empty, and he said, like this. And he said, that's because when we reach the end, we realize we're going to take nothing with us. And we sat quietly for a minute. I said, so have we solved the secret of happiness? And he said, yes, we have. And I waited, and I said, are you going to tell me? He said, yes, I will. You ready? I said, yes, I'm definitely ready. Be satisfied. I said, that's it. Be grateful. That's it. For all you have, for all the love you've received, and for all God has given you. I said, that's it? That's it, he said. And I have to tell you, in all the days and weeks and months and years since then, I've not been able to crack a hole in that theory of happiness. Be satisfied, be grateful for all you have, for all the love you've received, and all God has given you. And I think, you know, if you keep that philosophy through life, you'll pretty much be able to get through anything.
Well, Mitch, it's been fascinating to talk to you. I really do appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, Mitch Albom, who is the author of the very, very well-known Tuesdays with Maury, and now the newly released Have a Little Faith.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast, thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology. To hear more from Open House, visit openhouseonline.com.au.